Are we alone in the universe? Is anyone else out there? Is Earth a unique planet, the only place life could exist? Well, on this week's edition of Please Explain, we're looking into the search for extraterrestrial life and intelligent life, although we're talking about astronomy, not UFOs or alien abductions. And joining us are two scientists, Sarah Seeger, planetary science and physics professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Seth Shostak, senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. Welcome to our show.
Thanks very much, Leonard.
It's great to be here, Leonard.
Seth, when did the serious scientific search for extraterrestrial life begin?
Well, there were people thinking about it in the Victorian era, to be quite honest, and they were hoping to signal our buddies on Mars or maybe the moon. But the first modern experiment really only goes back about a half century to 1960, when an antenna was used in West Virginia to try and eavesdrop on aliens.
And is that what got you interested in the field of astronomy?
Well, probably not in astronomy. I was interested in astronomy from the age of eight. I think that's not so uncommon. But the idea of aliens, well, Leonard, I think just about every kid is interested in aliens in the same way they're all interested in dinosaurs. After all, they both have big teeth. They might be threatening, but fortunately, they're either far away or they're extinct. So I think it was cheesy sci-fi films I saw as a kid.
Sarah, you're searching specifically for planets. Is that what got you interested in astronomy in the first place?
Well, my story is totally different from Seth's. I just always loved the sky, the stars, the moon, and everything. And when I was in graduate school about 15 years ago, that's when exoplanets orbiting sun-like stars were first discovered. And so I jumped on the chance to work on it.
How many possible stars and planetary systems are out there?
Well, possible. We believe now, statistically speaking, that every single star in our Milky Way galaxy has at least one planet. And our Milky Way galaxy has over 100 billion stars. Then more concretely, it's more like a few thousand planets that we know of for sure.
Seth, what kind of evidence do you look for at the SETI Institute, which we should point out stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence?
Yes. Well, we have a lot of scientists here, I guess, and 70 or so down the halls. And most of them are looking for life that might be nearby. For example, microbes under the rusty, dusty surface of Mars, or maybe under the icy outer skin, if you will, of some of the moons of Jupiter, or maybe even Saturn. But the group that I'm in is actually looking for life that could hold up its side of the conversation, if you will, intelligent life, the kind of life you see in the movies and on television. And that involves a handful of people. It's a very small project. We try and do it by eavesdropping on, well, their equivalent of WNYC. We're trying to pick up radio waves they might be sending into space.
Well, if we received it now, wouldn't it have been sent into space thousands or millions of years ago?
That could be, but actually we tend to look at stars that are, at least in astronomical terms, relatively nearby. So these are stars that are maybe 10 light years away, 100 light years away, maybe 1,000 light years away. So, the message might be old, 10 or 100 years old, 1,000 years old. But, I read Julius Caesar when I was a kid in high school, and that message was 2,000 years old, and it was still interesting. So I don't worry too much about the fact that the message is old.
Does SETI assume that there is life out there?
Well, of course we do. We wouldn't do the experiment if we didn't think there was a chance. But on the other hand, science is not about what you believe to be true. It's what you can find.
Sarah, or both of you in this case, is this field a numbers game with all the stars and possible planets out there? Is it statistically likely that there is intelligent life?
Well, I don't know. I thought Sarah might jump in with that. Sarah pointed out that, essentially all stars have planets. Now, we don't know what fraction of those planets might be suitable for life. I mean, there's one paper that was published about a year ago that suggests maybe 1 in 5. Well, maybe it's 1 in 5, maybe it's 1 in 10, maybe it's 1 in 100. But the point is, it's not 1 in 1,000,000. And so given that, in the Milky Way galaxy, Sarah, what, maybe 1 trillion planets, it's like buying 1 trillion lottery tickets. It just begs belief to think that they're all sterile. That's kind of the assumption here. It's sort of a big numbers argument.
But, at the same time, we have no evidence that there is life elsewhere, and I've often encountered biologists who do not like us speculating. They'll say, well, so what? So you have 1 trillion Earths. in our universe or in even our own galaxy the possibility of a billion Earths. So what? So really, it's just a matter of time. We want to wait and find signs of life on another planet, either by hearing from them directly, like SETI's working on, or by looking for gases in a planet atmosphere that might be made by life.
Can you explain the Drake equation?
Yes, this was actually, it wasn't conceived to be something mathematical, but just as an agenda for a meeting that was held in 1961 in West Virginia. A small group of people, a dozen of them, who had come together to consider this idea that maybe you could find the aliens not by, you know, going there as they do on Star Trek or waiting for them to land here as one third of the population thinks is happening, but simply by eavesdropping on these radio signals. So in order to organize that meeting, Frank Drake concocted this little equation. It's a very simple formula that tries to estimate how many societies are out there right now that are broadcasting signals that are going through our bodies as we sit here. And, you know, it obviously involves how many stars are out there and what fraction of them have planets and what fraction of those planets have ever cooked up biology and so forth. So that's what's called the Drake equation. It's a great way to kind of organize your thinking about this problem, but it doesn't give you any real answer because there are a lot of the terms of the equation that are simply unknown.
My guests are Seth Shostak, senior astronomer and director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute, and Sarah Seeger, planetary science and physics professor at MIT. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sarah, what are you doing to search for planets? And what kinds of tools are you using to search for Earth-like planets?
Well, one thing is that there are just so many ways to find exoplanets. There are maybe at least six different ways, all doing different things. The one I'm focusing on right now, literally as we speak, we call it the Starshade. We're actually trying to design and build and in the future launch a giant screen in space. It would be about 100 feet in diameter, and it would block out a star, just like putting your hand in front of your face to block out the sun. But the Starshade would fly in space, and many thousands of kilometers away, there'd be a telescope. The Starshade would block out the light of a sun-like star, so that a small, faint planet like Earth could be seen directly.
You could see it orbiting the star that you've eclipsed.
Exactly.
Where are the most likely places to find them?
Well, right now, it's really the question of which stars can we look around? Because, you know, despite the fact that our galaxy has hundreds of billions of stars, we still, even with the most sophisticated space telescope we can think of, we can still only study the very nearest stars. So we do have our favorite star list, and believe it or not, the team spends many hours arguing over, you know, when we build and launch the Starshade, which stars will we look at first. But mostly it's stars within, close to us, within 10 or tens of light years.
How do you get the Starshade and a telescope to line up in space?
Great question, and it is one of the hard problems. We call it formation flying. Essentially, the Starshade would have an LED bank, a bank of really bright lights. It would also have a laser beacon on it, and it would know roughly where it is in space, and then it would communicate. It would have a direct radio link to the telescope far away, and that telescope would have a camera so it could see the light coming from the Starshade. That's part of the story of how it would line up.
Now, we are just talking about looking at the Milky Way, I assume, which is just a small slice of the universe. Would it be possible to look beyond it?
Not right now. I mean, there may be one of the techniques that could reach to the next nearest, you know, the so-called Magellanic Clouds. In the future, we could imagine maybe looking at the next nearest galaxy. But no, right now we're really confined to our own galaxy and mostly to the neighborhood right around our own sun.
Seth, what tools do you use?
Well, if you're talking about the astrobiologists here that are interested in life that might not be quite so intelligent but might be rather nearby, as they say on Mars or some of the moons of the outer solar system, then they're relying on, you know, NASA's spacecraft that actually go there and just can, you know, maybe dig up the evidence. So there's that. But if you're talking about the intelligent search for life, what we do is, indeed, we have some antennas. They're about 300 miles north of San Francisco in the Cascade Mountains of California. They're located there not because of the cuisine, but because the mountains kind of shade the antennas from all the radio interference from the Bay Area here. So we use those, and we point them at nearby stars, hoping to, you know, just pick up a signal that would tell us, well, you know, there's somebody out there that's clever enough to build a radio transmitter. That's our kind of our definition of intelligence. Another kind of experiment that we've been in the past, hope to get into in the future, is to look for flashing lights, because it turns out that you can use light to communicate too. Everybody who knows about fiber optics knows that's possible. So we try, you know, various experiments looking for, if you will, ET's technology.
Well, humans lived on Earth for a long time before they developed any transmitters. So there could be millions of planets out there with people who are living in the equivalent of Middle Ages or the Napoleonic era.
Yes, that's
and we wouldn't know anything about them.
No,
and even if they did have the ability to transmit, perhaps they would use a kind of technology that would be imperceptible to us.
Well, all of those things are possible, and certainly that first point that, you know, the Earth has been sitting around here, obviously friendly to life, and in fact being carpeted with life for at least 3.5 or 4 billion years, and there were no radio signals leaking off the Earth. You could have, you know, the Klingons could have looked at the Earth with their radio telescopes for 4 billion years and not seen anything. So the chances of success here depend on more than them simply advancing to the point where they could build this kind of signaling technology. They also have to keep doing it for a long time. It's unclear how long, you know, we'll do that. I'm sure people at the station there hope that WNYC has a very long future. I think that the radio is a technique that you will always use myself. But yes, it could be that there's some physics we don't know that allows you to communicate across the distances between the stars at, you know, either at a faster rate, which violates the physics we know, or, you know, simply for less energy costs or something else that makes it more advantageous. It could be. But that's not a very good argument for not listening, because that's like telling Chris Columbus, hey, Chris, forget these wooden ships. Just wait 500 years and you can cross the Atlantic in 6 hours eating bad food off your lap. Yeah, you could tell him that. But the wooden ships, it turned out, were good enough. So we continued to do the experiment.
Are we only listening, or are we also sending out specific messages?
We don't do that. We leave that to high-frequency, high-powered transmitters on Earth like FM radio and television and most visibly,
well,
actually,
Seth,
radars.
I think it's a good question of why not, because we're relying, at least in part, on an alien civilization sending us a signal directly, purposely. So why do you think we aren't doing it?
Because we would advertise where we are if we sent out specific messages into space.
Leonard, you know, if you have a dental appointment next week, you might want to worry about that. I wouldn't worry about the fact that we're signaling into space, because while it's possible that our signals betraying our position here could incite some alien civilization to come here and ruin everybody's day, the facts are that it's very easy to show that any society that has that ability, that could go from one star system to another, also has the ability to pick up the transmissions we've been sending willy-nilly into space since the Second World War. So that horse has left the barn.
Are you scanning for possible signals in certain areas?
We rely on the work of Sarah and others, of course, for that. If they find planets that are relatively nearby that look like they might be hospitable to life, of course we look at those first. But, this is a numbers game. It's been pointed out over and over that you could have looked at the Earth, you know, and not found signals for a very long time. So you have to have a very large observing list to have any reasonable chance of success, I think.
Sarah, are our planet and our solar system rare within the universe?
Can you repeat that?
How common are planets like Earth and our solar system in general within the universe?
Well, we don't know exactly how common our solar system is. We haven't found any solar system copies yet. That said, we think that small rocky planets are very, very common. We don't have a precise number for you, but, you know, something like 20% of stars should have a terrestrial-sized planet somewhere orbiting it. So we think they're extremely common, and that really they're just waiting to be found. But don't forget that Venus and Earth, they're both terrestrial planets, but they're so different from each other when you think about the surface conditions.
And when we go to Mars, we discover that even though there was water there probably, there doesn't seem to be any sign of life.
Not so far.
So, not so far. You think that there's still a possibility?
I hope. I'm one of the crowd of people who hope that there is some kind of life or some fossilized life, and it's not going to be obvious. Perhaps there are pools of water beneath the surface of Mars that have the right conditions. We'll see.
Seth, a listener wonders whether there have been any detected radio signals which might suggest or can't be ruled out as signals from extraterrestrial intelligence.
Well, there have been what some people call false alarms, particularly in the past, because in the old days, the way you would do this experiment is you had a computer with a big tape drive on it, like you'd see in the old sci-fi films, you know, sort of recording all the data, and then you would look at it weeks or months later, and then you'd find signals. It's easy to find signals, and you wouldn't know what they were. So in 1977, in fact, a big antenna at the Ohio State University picked up a signal that, you know, was printed out on reams of computer paper, and the astronomer looked at it the next day, and he found this big signal, and he wrote "Wow" next to it. So this has become known as the "Wow" signal, and it has a certain notoriety even among the public as a signal that could have been ET, and maybe it was, but it was never seen a second time, and it was observed immediately. Within 1 minute, it was observed a second time and not seen, and it's never been seen again, although people have looked. So, you know, you can say, well, it was ET, and he only sent one ping, and then he went to lunch or whatever. You can say all that, but it's not science. If you can't verify that the signal is, you know, truly extraterrestrial, deliberately produced, then it's an interesting story and nothing more than that. So, you know, I'm not sure I would call it a false alarm, because that sounds as if it might have had an origin as a true ET transmission.
Extraterrestrial is the subject of today's Please Explain. We are talking with Seth Shostak, Senior Astronomer and Director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute, and Sarah Seeger, Planetary Science and Physics Professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you have any questions. Also, you can reach us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with more right after this. And we're back with today's Please Explain look at extraterrestrials, life, and planets that are like Earth, with Sarah Seeger, Planetary Science and Physics Professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Seth Shostak, Senior Astronomer and Director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. The physicist Enrico Fermi spoke about whether intelligent life is probably possible anyway elsewhere in the galaxy. Can you tell us his thoughts and explain the Fermi paradox?
Well, yeah, this may be an apocryphal story. There's some debate about whether it actually happened. But apparently in 1950, Fermi was having lunch with a couple of physicist friends in Los Alamos. And between two bites of a tuna fish sandwich or whatever, he said something like, where is everybody? And he wasn't referring to the lack of company at lunch. What he had done is done the very simple calculation of how long it would take a truly ambitious society, and a more advanced society than we are, to colonize every star system in the galaxy. And that's a pretty big project. We're not shovel ready for that. But, you know, it turns out you can do it in 30 million years, 40 million years, 50 million years. Depends a little bit on how fast your rockets are, but not very much. So that's a very short period of time compared to the age of the cosmos. And consequently, if somebody had wanted to do this, they should have done it, and we should see evidence of aliens everywhere. This is a bit like saying once the Spaniards started colonizing the Americas, within 30 years, there were Spaniards all up and down the coasts of the Americas, right? So it went very, very quickly. And so that was what became known as the Fermi paradox, the fact that we should expect aliens everywhere, and we don't see any, and consequently, either we're alone or there's something that interferes with galactic colonization. Personally, I tend to favor the second rather than the first.
And I'm grateful for that. Weren't the Soviets especially interested in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence for a time? Are scientists in other countries still searching?
The Soviets were. And in fact, they were very good at it, in the sense they didn't have a lot of money to build equipment, but they had some very clever theoreticians, and many of the kind of seminal ideas for SETI actually originated in the Soviet Union. They don't do very much anymore because there's just no money in Russia now. As far as whether other countries are doing this, trying to eavesdrop, as they say, on signals, the answer is most of them are not. The only foreign SETI experiment that I know of that's ongoing is in Italy at the University of Bologna.
I just want to interject with one thing, backing up to the Fermi paradox. So it turns out that the search for other planets and the search for other Earths and the hope of finding signs of life on them could help in that direction. I mean, if we go out there and find that Earths are extremely common and that signs of life on them are very common also, it gives us some hope of, you know, sorting through the options.
And directing our receptors or receivers in those directions, I assume.
Yeah, even our transceivers if we want to transmit.
Let's take a call. Our number here, by the way, 212-433-9692. Trevor from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air. Trevor?
Hello? Yes, hi. Hello.
Go ahead.
Just had a general question for those that you're speaking with. I'm very curious about sort of the spark that creates life on other planets. I mean, we look at moons like Europa, moons like Titan, you know, one has an atmosphere, one has water. But I'm very curious about everyone's take on what exactly sparks bacterial life and then that leads to, you know, whatever intelligent life after that. I've always felt like that's been a mystery.
Sarah, before you answer, and I want you to answer it, this is a really bad connection. What planet are you calling from, Trevor?
So I'm from Brooklyn.
Oh, well. Okay.
Planet Brooklyn.
Sarah?
Well, I was just going to say that's such a great question. We don't have an answer yet. Here on Earth, people are trying to figure out how did life originate on Earth. And they're trying to create artificial life in the lab in the way of cells. And that might help us understand at least how that happens. There are many theories for how it may have happened. But the whole sort of origin and evolution of life is still a big question. And if we can find signs of life elsewhere, the people who are working on that question, you'll have some hope that they may be able to sort through answers.
A listener, Michael, asks whether the fact that we have not yet detected radio transmission from ETs rules out that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. So we got to those extraterrestrial visits anyway.
Well, I don't think one has terribly much to do with the other, although I get phone calls every day from people who claim to have evidence that we're being visited. I honestly think, and this is guaranteed to antagonize some people, but I'll say it anyhow. I think that if we were being visited now, that would not be something that would be controversial. That would be something that was so obvious that the evidence would be stacked up in the American Museum of Natural History, right? I mean, there would be no reason to keep that secret. And there would be thousands of academics working away on this problem. There could be nothing more interesting than the thought that we might be being visited by aliens. But I don't think that the evidence is good enough. And what people will often say to me is, yes, but the U.S. government has concealed all that evidence. Well, if you really believe that, if you think the same government that runs the Postal Service could keep this quiet for more than 60 years, you have to ask whether the Bolivians and the Botswanans and the Belgians and Brazilians and so on, whether everybody else is also covering up that evidence or whether the aliens only like to visit the United States. To me, the evidence is not compelling.
Sarah, when you're searching for planets, are you looking for planets that are similar to Earth in terms of their distance from a sun that is similar to our sun?
Well, right now, just to back up a little, we're searching for anything. We're interested in any and all kinds of planets, and they are. There are planets from bigger than Jupiter and all orbits and all masses and all sizes. We are just fixated on Earth, and I know that's what our call today is about. But yes, ultimately, we'd want to find a planet like Earth in an Earth-like orbit. But if you ask it a different way and say, well, what kind of planet do people think could have life on it, there's actually quite a wide range. As long as the planet has the right surface temperatures, where it's not too hot and not too cold, but just right for complicated molecules, and that has a liquid on it so the molecules can react with each other and form something more complicated, it could be that planet.
How far into space can you see so far?
Well, so far we've seen thousands of light years away, and that's for planet detection. In the future, when we want to look at atmospheres of very small planets, then we'll only be able to see tens of light years away.
Bob from Rego Park, hi, you're on the air.
Leonard, how you doing? Great job. Leonard, I'd like to ask a question. You know, in New York City today it's in the sunny, it's in the 20s. The sun is out. There's 100 billion stars approximately that was just said on your show. How much does that affect the actual temperature, given that if there wasn't 100 billion, if there was only a couple of million stars, would we have no life on this Earth? How much does the 100 billion stars affect the actual temperature on Earth?
Do we receive any warmth from stars that are so far away,
Sarah?
No, actually. They're just too far away to have any effect at all. Although we can see their light, it doesn't do anything to warm our planet.
Seth, what was involved in the Phoenix Project, which began the 1990s?
Yeah, that was a flagship project that we ran for, as you say, about 10 years, beginning in the 1990s, beginning in 1995, using antennas around the world, big radio telescopes they're called, but they just look like, I don't know, your backyard satellite dish on steroids, most of them. And we looked at about 1,000 nearby star systems with a receiver that could tune over a very wide range of the radio dial. We looked at about 2 billion channels, if you will, for each star system that we looked at. So that was an early reconnaissance of the sky, looking for signals. We didn't find anything, obviously. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today the way we are. But it was the first step, and it was called Project Phoenix for various internal reasons. But that's what that was. Today, and this is a point that the public sometimes does miss, we're not just sitting around with earphones doing the same thing that Jodie Foster did in the movie Contact year after year. That would be extraordinarily tedious and not very effective. The technology we use changes. It improves. Every 2 years, our experiments get roughly twice as fast. So this experiment is speeding up, and that's why I remain optimistic that if we can keep doing this, that the success may happen this generation.
Can you tell us about the Allen Telescope Array?
That's what we use, and that's the array of 42 now antennas, although we hope to build more. It's always a question of money. It's all privately funded, the whole operation.
Small dishes rather than one large dish. Why
exactly.
Are they better?
It's better because this is just a matter of what's called scaling laws. This is just a matter of, if you will, how much telescope collecting area can you build for a given number of dollars? And it turns out that by instead of building one big antenna, you build a lot of small ones. You can build a much bigger instrument that way, and you can that's possible because of the inexpensive nature of electronics now, that you can in fact get away. Instead of building an antenna that's as big as a small city, build a lot of small ones that have the same area for a lot less money. It's economics.
NASA's space shuttle program has been retired due to budget cuts. Seth just pointed out that the Allen Telescope Array is paid for by private money. There is still some space exploration, but is this having an effect on your work, Sarah? You wanted to send something up into space that would put up a shade. Where would the money come from?
Well, right now, the only practical source is NASA. And it's true that budgets are being strained and that, you know, as astronomers over the last decades have done what we'll call the easy science or the accessible science, we do move to more and more complicated and larger facilities that are required. So this is definitely a challenge for us.
The NASA recently approved the transiting exoplanet survey satellite. How will that work, and when will it be ready to use?
Well, that acronym is TESS, and it's an MIT-led NASA mission. It will launch in 2017. TESS is an exoplanet finder. It will discover exoplanets by a technique we haven't talked about yet. And what it will do is it's actually TESS is a spacecraft. It's about the size of an industrial washing machine, and it has 4 very specialized cameras on it. If you could imagine a very glorified telephoto lens of the kind you might see with a giant baffle, like when you think of the paparazzi, we really just have custom-made ones like that, about that size, and 4 of them, and they're all attached to a platform. And Kepler will look all, Kepler rather, it's like a next-generation Kepler. It's called TESS, and it will look all around the sky, looking at a couple of million of stars, actually. And it'll be looking at stars, looking for planets that have a very special configuration. That is, they go in front of their stars, as seen from the telescope. They're lined up just so with their star and with the telescope. And we're going to hopefully find thousands of planets. Hopefully 50 of them will be terrestrial-like. And what we aim to do is to follow those up to look at their atmospheres with a hope of maybe finding some signs of life on them.
Which would, water would be a major evidence of that?
Well, water vapor in the atmosphere of a rocky planet would be evidence for liquid water oceans on the surface of the planet, and that we think is a requirement for life, but it wouldn't be evidence for life.
Let's take another call. Jim from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wonder if there is indeed a term for what might be an anthropomorphic bias, where we're looking, searching in areas where we assume the need for what sustains our life, but we're dismissing and ignoring areas where life unknown to us is supportable in a way that's unknown to us.
Well, I love that question, and we actually are. We're trying to stretch our minds as much as humanly possible, and admittedly, we have a word for it, terra-centric. It's like being self-centered with respect to the Earth, and we do. It's a little complicated to get into those details here, but we think there are some universals that life needs the right temperature if it's too hot. Only we can only have atoms. Molecules will not form, and we can't have what's required for anything complex made out of chemistry. But really, we do. We consider planets that could be very massive, that may have very massive atmospheres. So we are trying as best we can to think of all types of planets that might be able to host life with only a few very basic assumptions.
But in science fiction, that life always seems to be, even though it doesn't look like humans, tends to have two eyes, then some nostrils right below them, and then a mouth below that.
Well, yes, but unlike what Seth is referring to, or intelligent life, and even he's not referring to what the life might look like, in the case for exoplanets and the search for planets and signs of life, we will not see the life at all. We'll just see the byproduct gas that the life emits. So it's, you know, we love to speculate, but it's not science to think of what, you know, what would it look like, how would the creature look. We're just looking for signs that it's present.
Now, Seth, we only have about 10 seconds left, but I wanted to ask you this. The physicist Phil Morrison called SETI the archaeology of the future. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, I think what he's saying is that what anybody we find is more advanced technically than we are. So we get a little bit of information. If we can understand anything coming our way, we get a little bit of information about a society that has gone beyond ours, at least in its technical capabilities.
I thank you both so much for being on our show today, our Please Explain segment on extraterrestrials. Seth Shostak, senior astronomer, the director for the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute, and Sarah Seeger, planetary science and physics professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.